and east across the country, and winds will change direction to a strong northwesterly. So by Thursday, it will be a day of sunny spells and scattered showers, but it will feel much, much colder than actually the temperatures suggest. Although we'll see highs of 8 to 10 Celsius, when you factor in the strength of the wind, it'll probably feel more like 2 to 6 degrees. That's your weather.
Louise, thank you. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week and more from the letters of John F. Kennedy. JFK has achieved the highest office in the land, and with it all the concerns and responsibilities imaginable. This is vividly caught in missives to and from the new president, beginning with his famous inauguration.
And so, my fellow Americans,
on November 8, 1960, 42-year-old John F. Kennedy was elected President of the United States. One of the highlights of the inauguration was the reading of a poem by Robert Frost. Kennedy, a longtime admirer of Frost and his work, readily agreed to the reading, but not before reminding his Secretary of the Interior, "You know that Robert Frost always steals any show he's part of." The day after Frost received Kennedy's telegram inviting him to participate, he sent his own telegram of acceptance.
"If you can bear at your age the honor of being made President of the United States, I ought to be able, at my age, to bear the honor of taking part in your inauguration. I may not be equal to it, but I can accept it for my cause, the arts, poetry, now for the first time taken into the affairs of statesmen."
Although Frost had written a new work entitled Dedication for the occasion, he had trouble reading the faintly typed poem. Instead, he recited his poem, The Gift Outright, from memory. The Kennedy-Frost relationship would develop into one of great warmth and mutual admiration, so much so that, despite the poet's age, Kennedy would send Frost in 1962 to the Soviet Union as an unofficial envoy. On the eve of his departure, Frost wrote to Kennedy,
"You must know a lot about me besides my rank from my poems, but think how the professors interpret the poems. I am almost as full of politics and history as you are. I like to tell the story of the mere sailor boy from upstate New York, who, by favor of his captain and the American consul at St. Petersburg, got to see the Tsar in St. Petersburg with the gift in his hand of an acorn that fell from a tree that stood by the house of George Washington. That was in the 1830s, when proud young Americans were equal to anything. He said to the Tsar, 'Washington was a great ruler, and you're a great ruler, and I thought you might like to plant the acorn with me by your palace.' And so he did. I have been having a lot of historical parallels lately. A big one between Caesar's imperial democracy that made so many millions equal under arbitrary power and the Russian democracy. Ours is a more senatorial democracy, like the Republic of Rome. I thought I saw the Russians and the American democracies drawing together, theirs easing down from a kind of abstract severity to taking less and less care of the masses. Ours creeping up to take more and more care of the masses as they grew innumerable. I see us becoming the two great powers of the modern world in noble rivalry. I am frightened by this big undertaking, but I was more frightened at your inauguration. Great times to be alive, aren't they?"
Kennedy's inaugural address is regarded as being among the greatest speeches of its kind ever delivered. From far-off Tanganyika, America's most popular actor, John Wayne, interrupted his filmmaking to express his feelings.
"Congratulations, Mr. President. It was thrilling reading your inaugural speech. Stop. It made us even prouder that we, are Americans.
Of all the letters, telegrams, and cables, none was perhaps more warmly received than that from British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, the man Kennedy was counting on to be his staunchest ally in the battle against the communist world.
"What a great impression your inaugural speech has made in this country."
Less welcome was the cable from Walter Ulbricht, chairman of the communist-controlled section of the divided city of Berlin.
"Mr. President, I send you my best wishes. I express a hope that your government activity will contribute to the relaxation of international tension and to the peaceful settlement of international questions at issue."
At a time of new beginnings and hope for a brighter world future, Ulbricht's cable was a reminder of the challenges that John Kennedy had inherited, as reflected by the State Department memorandum.
"Since the United States does not recognize the so-called German Democratic Republic, which is a Soviet puppet regime imposed on the people of East Germany by the Soviet Union, no reply should be made to this cable."
The Cold War required Kennedy to deal constantly with explosive issues throughout the world, issues so vital to the future of people everywhere that even his domestic policies and programs were motivated by the struggle between democracy and the spread of communism. Several of these programs had been germinating before his election. He had long been disturbed by research showing that potential American military recruits were being rejected at an alarming rate, as physically unfit for duty. He was equally concerned that each year more than twice the number of American children failed physical fitness tests than did European youngsters, and particularly Russian youngsters. Shortly after his election, he published an article in a national magazine describing a program he intended to introduce as soon as he entered the White House.
"Our struggle against aggressors throughout history has been won on the playgrounds and corner lots and fields of America."
At the heart of the article was Kennedy's belief that physical fitness was the business of the federal government. And within weeks of his taking office, the president's Council on Physical Fitness launched an awareness campaign that included thousands of posters, brochures, television and radio kits, and exercise books, all designed to make physical fitness, especially for school children, a national agenda. Even Snoopy, Charles Schulz's beloved character, encouraged youngsters to do their daily dozen exercises. The importance of staying fit was reflected in the White House mail. Not all the letters Kennedy received, however, praised the program. Young Gladys McPherson wrote,
"It is impossible to find round-toe, flat-heel shoes to fit sub-teens in women's sizes. I'm sure you don't expect the Army or Marines to hike 50 miles in pointed toes. Please, convince Mrs. Kennedy to buy and wear in public round-toed shoes so that every style-conscious woman would demand the manufacturers make them. Please, Mr. President, do this favor for the women of America to whom God gave rounded feet instead of pointed ones. We have suffered for a long time."
Another young woman, in sentiments well ahead of her time, described what she saw as another shortcoming of the physical fitness program.
"We have a very fine gym, but we girls are not about to use it for that purpose. The boys have many activities, such as football, basketball, and etc., but we girls run around flabby. If we say anything to the principal about the girls having a program of any sort, he tells us to go home and do our own exercises."
And Richard Millington.
"Dear President Kennedy, I would like to know why, in this age of stress on physical fitness, there are still paunchy teachers around."
Just as Kennedy had been disturbed that American youngsters lagged behind their Russian counterparts in fitness, he was also concerned that the Soviet Union had hundreds of men and women, scientists, engineers, doctors, and nurses prepared to spend their lives abroad in the service of world communism, while the United States had no such program. 2 weeks before his election, in a speech at San Francisco's Cow Palace, he proposed a Peace Corps of talented men and women who would volunteer to devote themselves to the progress and peace of developing countries. Some 50 years after he envisioned it, the Peace Corps can boast of more than 210,000 volunteers working in 139 countries, and it is still growing. Many of the letters Kennedy wrote would deal with the most thorny and dangerous issues any American president ever had to face. Others, like the one he sent to John Galbraith's son on his birthday, would be characterized by the Kennedy wit.
January 26, 1961. Master James Kenneth Galbraith, 30 Francis Avenue, Cambridge 38, Massachusetts. Dear Jamie, I understand that you were born in the last year of the last Democratic administration and are now celebrating your 9th birthday in these first 2 weeks of mine. I hope that the long Republican years have not hurt you too much and that you will grow up to be at least as good a Democrat as your father, but possibly more of a more convenient size. My best wishes for a happy birthday. Sincerely, John F. Kennedy.
Nelson Rockefeller was the governor of New York and one of the Republican Party's leading candidates to oppose Kennedy when he ran for re-election in 1964. In November 1961, Rockefeller's youngest son, Michael, disappeared while studying the Asmat tribe in southern New Guinea. 2 weeks into the search, the grateful and still hopeful governor wrote to Kennedy to thank him for his concern and assistance.
December 1, 1961. Dear Mr. President, the deep human understanding which motivated your wire last week, at the time of Michael's disappearance, with your offer of all possible assistance, is something I shall never forget, and is something for which I shall be eternally grateful to you. Thanks, importantly, to your personal concern, no possible means of search was overlooked. The Department of State and Defense, as well as the CIA, gave every assistance. The Department of Defense enlisted the full support of the Netherlands Air and Naval Units to supplement the all-out effort of their civilian personnel, and also an Australian Air and Army Helicopter Unit, which did a superb job. In addition, the 7th Fleet, as well as the Air Force in Hawaii, offered to send task forces. However, these latter two offers were declined with the deepest appreciation in view of the fact that every possible avenue of approach was being covered. I would like to add that both the Dutch Catholic and American Protestant missionaries were uniquely kind and generous in their help. While as yet no trace of Mike has been found, over 1,500 square miles of sea, 150 miles of coastline have been searched, and all of the villages in the area have been visited. The search will continue in a jungle area of approximately 1,000 square miles, conducted by native Papuans. And I'm confident that if he was able to make the shore, he will be found.
Despite an intensive search, the 23-year-old Rockefeller was never found.
Colin Stinton was the narrator of The Letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin W. Sandler. The other voices were Trevor White, Peter Marinka, Stephen Greif, and Kelly Burke. And Richard Lang was John Kennedy. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow it's The Race into Space, at the same time here on Radio 4. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. Now time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Wednesday the 13th of November. There are warnings of gales in Viking.